This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In podcast network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 6 of the Asian Cinema Film Club. I am your host as always, Edward Jones from the Dirty DVD Hell. And joining me, of course, is my co-host, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Hello, everybody.
Now, if this is your first time, obviously, tuning into the podcast, this is the Asian Cinema Film Club, where myself and Stephen aim to provide an introduction to the wonderful and occasionally weird world of Asian cinema by each week highlighting a different film for your viewing taste to enjoy. This week, we're going to be looking at the cult horror Death Note ahead of its American remake, which is, as of the time of recording, due out on the 26th of this month via Netflix. So we thought it was due note that we obviously went back and looked at the live-action original to obviously not only catch up and just obviously see if we can find out what the obsession with Death Note is, as it's certainly one of those films that since its release, and especially since the anime release and the manga, has gone to become this huge cultural icon. But before we obviously get into our featured film for this evening, we start, as always, by, since the last episode, what's been holding your attention?
Do you know, Asian film-wise, I haven't watched anything since we last spoke. And that, no, that's going to probably say that every episode, don't I? But I'm afraid it's Game of Thrones time at the moment, so that takes my watching, rewatching, and catching up with that.
It is, but I mean, it's only a short season of Game of Thrones, so
yeah. I mean, so I'll be back in the saddle.
You'll
soon.
Be back in the. You at least have something to fall back on when everyone else is having like withdrawal symptoms that Game of Thrones is over for like another year again.
And then over forever.
Yes, I mean, I know it's, Game of Thrones is like, whenever I watch it, it just makes me want to go off and watch something more fantasy-based to sort of like tide myself over. Perhaps rewatching Dragon Wars wasn't the greatest move after this last episode. Which basically is just all about the end sequence, and it's just nonsense up until that point. But, you know, it's dragons, and dragons,
I mean,
cool.
I gotta be honest. I'm not a huge fan of fantasy, and it took me a long time to get into it. But the dense plotting and the water cooler chat has got me rather addicted to it. And I also am very soft at anything with dragons in, to be honest with you.
That's cool. I mean, obviously, staying on the fantasy sort of track, I mean, a different sort of fantasy style of directing would be that belonging to the very underrated, in my opinion, Hitoshi Matsumoto, whose film A Symbol I actually checked out this week. This is from 2009, and the best way I can describe it is that it's like Saw with jokes, in that this guy, played by the director himself, he wakes up in this white room and basically has to try and find a way out, and the walls are all covered with these like phallic like switches that whenever he presses them, weird things happen in the room, like a plate of sushi appear or a potted plant, and he has to try and find a way out of this room. At the same time, there is this parallel storyline of this mass Mexican wrestler called Escargot Man, who is getting on in his age, and he's sort of worried whether he's still going to be able to have a career as a Mexican wrestler, especially as he's facing younger opponents. And the whole film, it runs these two parallel storylines until the end, where you realize just how the two are connected. Now, Matsumoto directed Big Man Japan, these parody on kaiju movies. He also directed what arguably the most perverted movie ever in R100, its title as well, meaning that essentially no one under the age of 100 should be able to view it. Are you familiar with Matsumoto's work? Are you a fan? Where do you sort of stand with him?
I've heard of this film. I'm just having a look now to see. Well, that sounds crazy. I'm aware of him. I think the only thing I've seen is R100. which is a interesting little piece. It's not for children. I'm just trying to think if I'd seen anything else. I mean, the problem is, of course, with Asian humour, it can utterly not travel well. Certainly, Japanese humour, I think, doesn't travel. So when it's black and dark,
yeah,
I don't know. I don't know if that helps it or hinders it, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's, for myself, I found his films incredibly funny. It's a very warped sort of sense of humour, especially in the case of R100, where you basically have this salaryman who is lonely, so he signs up for this escort sort of service. And basically, at any point, these dominatrix figures will appear from nowhere and basically beat the hell out of him. And they've all got these weird and wonderful sort of fetishes, like we've got the queen of spitting, we've got the queen of mastication, and they all provide different services, should we say. And none of them, I would say, are sexy in any sort of particular way, but somehow that really works with this guy, as we see constantly after each encounter, this vibrating background behind him. And it's, again, it's one of those weird films, you're not sure why you're watching it, much like if you watch something like Dogtooth, but at the same time, there's certainly something there which makes the work so appealing. And I think, like, Sion Sono is one of those directors that I think needs more recognition. Certainly, Sono is now finally getting the recognition from, like, films like Do You Play in Hell and Tokyo Tribe are sort of getting that recognition finally. But Matsumoto is still sort of on the outskirts. He's still very much an underground sort of presence, especially for Asian cinema fans. I mean, his last film was in 2013 with R100. And he's only got a short little back catalogue of films. I mean, he's only directed 4 films, Big Man Japan, Symbol, Scabbardless Samurai, and R100. So it's not the longest back catalogue of films to work through, but I think if you're feeling brave and want to see something a bit different, then certainly his films are worth checking out. Although, as you said already, I mean, anything regarding Asian humour, especially to Western audiences, you really got to take it with a pinch of salt and just sort of try and roll with it the best you can until you get sort of accustomed to the humour, so to speak.
Yeah, and I think that's something. I'm pretty sure we're going to cover a couple of Asian comedies in the coming months, and I think that'll be a theme we'll return to, the untranslatability of certainly, so both in terms of culture and of course language being a barrier, but slapstick always wins. Nothing's funnier than the a man for slipping on a banana skin, right?
That's what we like to believe anyway. But I mean, talking of untranslatable things, I mean, the other series which has been holding my interest has been the anime series Tokyo Ghoul, which is currently just wrapped up its run on Viceland, but they are showing like all their anime series all available via the Viceland on demand service. And Tokyo Ghoul, I feel, has been one of those series that's been very unfairly painted, because it's a horror series and a lot of anime lists tend to focus on more the violent aspects, especially of some of the later episodes, and kind of missed out on just what a unique twist on the vampire mythos this series is, as we've got this young boy who goes on a date with this girl who's he's absolutely besotted with, only for her to turn out to be a ghoul, in this case, who bites him and then turns him into a ghoul as well. And it's about him dealing with adapting to his new situation. At the same time, there's government agents that are trying to hunt down the ghouls, and it's a really fascinating take. I mean, I don't like vampire films, and the whole mythos feels very overworked, so to actually get a kick out of something like Tokyo Ghoul, and I think as well the fact that it's not just gratuitous sort of fan service, that in Tokyo Ghoul, yes, there is some splatter and certainly some hyper violence sort of craziness in there, but it's all at the same time feels very justified. It's none of the sort of like what we saw in like the early 90s, which were just like splatter and tentacles. Everything in this series feels like it's got a purpose, and it's, as I said, it's a real interesting title, especially if you're a fan of horror, to definitely worth giving a checking out.
And I probably will check it out because I know it's only got 12 episodes.
For the first season, yeah.
For the first season. That's a palatable, approachable meal for me.
Yeah.
I know, I appreciate there's other seasons and OVAs and things like that, but you know, just to be able to a bite size, few hours, long weekend, something like that, that might be of interest to me. So yes. I may check
you're looking at a 6-hour block. I think you probably binge watch Netflix for longer if you're into box set binges. Like if you try to watch the Defenders in one weekend or something, you'd probably spend more time doing that than you would clearing off the first season of Tokyo Ghoul.
Yeah, spoilers for my weekend, everybody.
But yeah. Yeah, I mean, obviously we're talking tonight about Death Note, and Death Note's coming up on Netflix with its American... how should we put this? I mean, is it remake? Is it reimagining? I mean, how are we describing this latest incarnation of the material?
As I understand it, I've read a few reviews and things around it. It's an American style remake, so it's a movie, right, rather than a series, yeah. I think. And it's based in America with American characters. They're changing the names on the whole. So, yeah, it's taken the essence of what the Death Note stories were around, and just translating it to an American audience, which actually I prefer when people go that way. So like when they remade Dark Water, they didn't just go and set it in Japan with white people. They culturally moved it across, and I'm a much bigger fan of that than just copying what already exists and taking the subtitles away, which is what can happen sometimes. So I don't know. I'll be very interested how the material is interpreted.
Okay. I mean, this obviously isn't the first property to be adapted from a manga or an anime into a live action format. I mean, since we are looking at Death Note, I thought we might as well look at some of the other great titles, which obviously started off as either manga or anime. So this is really my quick top five, should we say, titles that are worth checking out that obviously fall into this category. First off, and this is probably a really well-known title, but I don't think many people actually know that it started off as a manga, and that would be Park Chan-wook's Old Boy.
Yeah, absolutely. Although, it's a little bit different story-wise, isn't it? But it certainly takes its inspiration from a manga.
Yeah, and I mean, Old Boy, again, had a remake from Spike Lee. Yeah, that's the right one. Which I really liked. I know a lot of people out there were very defensive, and mainly because they love the Korean version so much that they didn't want to like admit that the American version would be any good, especially when you've got such a diversive director like Spike Lee lensing the film. But I think Josh Brolin really inhabited the character, and I thought that it really took the story in an interesting direction, and certainly visually was very interesting to look at, even if the famous sort of corridor sequence was extended so it was now a three-level fight in a what can probably be described as a parking garage. The original manga is still worth checking out, even though, as you said already, there is those differences between the material. Failing that, Park Chan-wook's, the whole of his Vengeance trilogy, from Symphony of Mr. Vengeance, Old Boy, through to my personal favourite, Lady Vengeance, is definitely worth checking out, and a must-have, I would say, for your collection.
Oh, couldn't agree more, and my favourite's Lady Vengeance as well, certainly the first half of it, and then it gets grim.
A more random one, should we say, and I think this won't be the first time I'm going to use that word on this list, and that is Ricky O, The Story of Ricky. This is probably the most bonkers martial arts movie you will see, as this is a film where a guy gets punched in the stomach and a hole appears through him, another guy gets his head crushed. It's just ultra violence from start to finish, and is probably one of those videos which has been dissected and cut up on YouTube more than any other film I know. It's of the last couple of years, I would say it's gained more of a cult following, but certainly for Asian cinema fans, they will probably be familiar with it already, just because it is absolutely bonkers. And probably quite unlike any other kung fu movie you see, as certainly what it lacks in actual martial arts, it certainly makes up in gratuitous violence and sheer randomness, making it an absolute must-see.
Of which I haven't seen it. Well, I'm fully aware of it. I've just never got around to watching it. But yes, it comes with full on cult credentials, that's for sure.
Next one is an adaptation of an anime, and that is Takashi Miike's Yataman. Now, this falls in Miike's later period, so it's been past his outlaw period, and this is him around the same time he was doing films like Ace Attorney and just basically experimenting more with filmmaking. And this is one of his certainly more lighthearted fares. It still has traits of the old Miike in there, such as one of the villains' plans being to be surrounded by all the women of the world, and we cut to a scene of him buried up to his neck in gorgeous Japanese schoolgirls while he's tickling some girl's foot. It's got that little bit of edge, Miike edge to it, which makes it still fun, but it's a hyperactive and colourful entry and features some giant mecha fun in there as well. But I mean,
still... Yeah, I love Yataman. For me, it's Miike's sort of love letter to sort of Saturday morning TV or Saturday morning Japanese TV, isn't it? It's fun and bright, but also, as you suggest, a little bit subversive as well, which for me is classic Miike. And that's a period of his work where he, and I might talk about something in a similar era in a minute myself, where he is trying different things, and you know, those people that know him from Audition and things like that, or his gangster craziness, the man works across genres with success and lack of success, but Yataman's a huge amount of fun.
Another random title, and that is Kashen. This film is absolutely bonkers. It features some truly hyperactive action sequence, to say the least, as our leader character is seen not only karate chopping robots in half, he's shown leaping 10 feet in the air as he battles sort of zombie cyborgs. I mean, I've watched this film 4 times and I'm still not overly sure what's happening, but it's very busy and there's a lot of things happening on the screen, and that keeps me amused. This is a film that, again, it reminds us of when we do CGI, that if you're going, and this is again why Asian cinema does CGI so well, is the fact that they realize that CGI should be used for creating things that you're unable to create with practical effects, and that's certainly what we get here, as we get live action blending with some wonderful warm CGI effects to absolutely incredible effect. And this is an absolutely stunning film, and one certainly worth checking out, as is the original anime series if you are a fan of old school cartoons, especially sort of old school Saturday morning cartoons, which obviously the original series could be best classified as being.
Yeah, it's another good choice. So the director, Kazuhiro Iwashita, or that's his real name, I think he's known as Kazuaki Kuria, isn't it? Hasn't made many films. I think Kashen was his first film, but he's very famous for making music videos, especially for his ex-wife Utada Hikaru, who's one of these massive Japanese / American stars. And I'm actually a big fan of his second film, Goemon, which is more of a, let's say, a historical, talks about one of the it's a story of Goemon, who is a famous Japanese historical sort of samurai figure, but done in the same way. Lots of CGI, lots of it's a visual treat. For me, Kashen, I kind of like the visuals of Kashen. I can't really dig it as anything other than a visual treat. But someone very worth digging out his films. Unfortunately, he hasn't made very many. I think he's only made 3, hasn't he?
Yeah, he's one of those directors who sort of only chooses to like make a film occasionally, it seems. And it's not sure why he has such a gap between films. I mean, I was really surprised. I mean, I saw Kashen, and then I saw Goemon, that was in my like local Blockbuster, and it was like, oh, from the director Kashen. I was like, oh, I've got to watch this. And then it's sort of been a bit of a a dry spell that just seems to continue on and on for him. I don't know why he doesn't direct more. Maybe it's like Luc Besson, who's just a fantastic director who doesn't particularly like directing.
Well, he did, of course, he did make Last Night, so he did try breaking into Hollywood with yet another retelling of the 47 Ronin. Clive Owen, Morgan Freeman, people like that in there. So again, visually very interesting, but it was a huge flop. And I guess it's hard to keep making movies if they don't make any money.
That's true. Now, for my final choice, I went back and forth over what I was going to choose for my, because I really wanted to go for GoGlow 13, Assignment Kowloon. And that's just mainly because I'm a huge Sonny Chiba fan. But ultimately, I went for Baby Cart in Peril, or the Lone Wolf and Cub series, as it's better known through its manga origins. Now, if you're unfamiliar with the series, it basically follows this shogun assassin who is trekking through this land he calls Hell with his infant son, who he pushes in a baby cart, which has got more hidden weapons and gadgets than that will put James Bond to shame. It's absolutely astounding, especially seeing as this is supposed to be feudal Japan. And basically, over the course of, was it six films?
Yep, six.
They continue on this quest of vengeance, taking on contracts to kill various people along the route. And it's an absolutely fantastic series. I mean, the first two films were cut down into Shogun Assassin, which it serves as kind of like a greatest hits for the first two. But if you kind of want an introduction to the series, or you just want to watch a best of for those first two films, it's still a really good cut. In the second film, Baby Cart the River Styx, we saw the Three Lords of Death, who had obviously gone to inspire the gods of rain, thunder, and lightning that we saw in John Carpenter's Big Trouble in Little China. This is a really fantastic series, and I know for the longest time Darren Aronofsky was like saying that he was going to remake it for an American audience, but like so many things that we see on Aronofsky's IMDb, such as his much muted adaptation of Fyodor Rozsak's Flicker, is yet to happen. I mean, he makes more promises to make things as Robert Rodriguez does. He's a very frustrating director, as much as I love him.
He does get attached to a lot of properties, doesn't he? And I think what happens is, like, he gets the elevator pitch, he gets to start a treatment, and then the film executives, I suspect, step back from it, because as fabulous and visionary a director as he is, I'm not convinced he's box office.
Well, yeah, I mean, his films are certainly, I mean, his best work originates from, like, golden period of the American indie. I mean, he made the greatest anti-drug movie ever with Requiem for a Dream. I think anyone who's seen that movie will not even want to touch an aspirin after seeing that movie, never mind doing drugs, so it's
Trainspotting's your aperitif, but Requiem for a Dream is just the most harrowing experience.
Yeah, and it's not even just like heroin that it focuses on. It's like any sort of, like, it basically tells this idea that if you pursue happiness, it will only end badly for you. If you're going to take diet pills so you can fit in the red dress, or if you're going to, as I said, you're going to sell drugs to so your girlfriend can buy her store, and or you can get out of the boardwalk, it's not going to end well for you.
No, and it does have the scariest fridge ever in it. And anyone who's seen it will know what I mean. But yeah, I think he's a fantastic director, but I do suspect that he gets attached to a lot of properties and probably with the best intentions, but yeah. I think he probably has trouble getting funding for a lot of it.
Okay. Now, we did throw this question up on our Facebook group. We do now have a page. If you search for Asian Cinema Film Club on Facebook, you can follow us on there, be our fake cyber friends. And we also post on there news pieces, reviews, that myself and Stephen have been working on our various blogs. As I said, we were posting news features. We tried to make it a real hub, so it's not just things relating to the show. And we obviously posed the question out there to our followers and asked what were their favorite live action adaptations. We got a couple of responses back from the Vern over Vern's Video Vortex, as well as Cinema Recall, which is on the That Moment In podcast network, which we of course are proud members of. He went with Speed Racer as his choice. Again, a classic manga and anime, and I feel it's a film that's certainly worth reevaluating now. Certainly with the race sequences, they look fantastic, even if at times it feels like you're watching the worldview of a kid with ADD on the ups and downs of a sugar binge. But it sure is a pretty film. I mean, are you a fan of Speed Racer?
It's visually stunning. And there'll be plenty of films which I will beat the drum for because they're visually stunning. I think it probably has got a bit of an unfair rep because it's not The Matrix. Do you know what I mean?
That's true.
Yeah, as everything they've done since has always been held up to that standard. But there's quite a few directors that have had that issue, isn't there? But yeah, it's like somebody with ADHD on LSD and 5,000 packets of Skittles. That's what they must see.
Pretty much.
I think it's okay. Yeah.
Now Bubba Wheat over at Flight Tights and Movie Nights, as well as Channel Superhero, has recommended Gantz, which I've yet to see. He also recommended the live action version of Kiki's Delivery Service, which I didn't actually know existed. I thought there was just the Ghibli version and that was it.
Okay, that's interesting. So Gantz I have seen, and it was on my list, which we'll run through in a minute.
Yep.
But I dropped it. It was on my original list of about 15 to 20. But yeah, that's a whole series of films. So that's well worth a watch. Kiki's Delivery Service, that was a couple of years ago they did a live action version of that. The Ghibli one is a million times better, but actually in its own way it's fairly charming. But it looks like a TV movie, and it looks like a Japanese TV movie, which means production values are okay. You'll find that a lot with Japanese cinema all round, really, which is that there are outliers, but on the whole, it's fairly static and washed out. But the story itself is charming. It's a charming story, full stop. So I'd accept that.
Cool. I mean, obviously, what was on your list? What would be your also rans for live action adaptations?
Well, I don't know about also rans, so I'll just run through them really quickly. So you already picked a Takashi Miike one. He's done a ton of adaptations. A lot of people might have thought we might have picked Ichi the Killer. Yataman, as you say, I'm a big fan of the Mole Song movies, the more recent couple of films he's done, which are fabulous fun. But mine is going to be a bit of a surprise to a lot of people, and I'm a huge fan of Ito Makoto, which is known as For Love's Sake over here in the UK. It's a musical. And I don't even like musicals, and there's two of them on this list. But it's like a sort of 60s era musical, Japanese schoolgirls, feral schoolgirls, sorry, and a sort of bit of West Side Story. There's some really catchy tunes, and it's just Miike at his most whimsical. The next one is probably one of the first Asian films I ever saw and that helped me fall in love with Asian cinema, is Azumi from 2003. It's a Chanabra film, and the sequel actually was directed by the director of tonight's film, wasn't it? But I love Azumi. It's a little bit long, but it just impressed me in the opening sequence. It just showed the balls, obviously, which I didn't know was from the original manga, to kill off half its main cast within the first 20 minutes of the film, which I love that. The next one is a little bit more hard to find, but well worth finding. It's another Japanese film called Nana to Karu. It's a love story about two young school kids who find love via BDSM. But don't think it's something sexual. It's a really charming, sweet story that uses the ideas of BDSM in it. There is a sex element, of course, but it's far more charming than that. There's actually a sequel, which I've never seen, but the first film of Nana to Karu is really worth watching. Next up is my all-time favorite comedy Japanese film, which is Therme Rome, which is based on the idea that a guy from Roman times time travels to the present and then takes things he sees and reinvents them back in the past. It sounds crazy. All the Romans are Japanese. And when he travels to the future, he doesn't really know what he's doing. And he thinks they're like foreign invaders because he travels to Japan and discovers lots of things about baths. So obviously you get the connection there between the Roman baths and the water and all the things that the Romans did in that area with the Japanese obsession with bathing and computer-driven toilets and public baths and things like that. It stars both the lead actress from Atsumi, funnily enough, but I'm just trying to find the guy's name now. What's he called? It's Hiroshi Abe, who's a 6-foot-tall Japanese model who's in a whole bunch of films, and you will have recognised him. But Therme Rome, and its sequel isn't too bad either, but it's just a crazy fun, genuinely funny film. If I've picked Takashi Miike, I've got to pick one from Sion Sono, and I utterly adore Tokyo Tribes, or Tokyo Tribe as I think it's called here. It's a rap musical.
Yeah.
From beginning to end. I was lucky enough to see it in a cinema with a proper sound system, and even translated into English, it just works. It feels much more like a Takashi Miike film, actually, because it's got aspects of cannibal gangster families, and it's set in the near future. But it's just a fabulous cinematic experience, which was made in Sono's 7 films in a year, which he did a couple of years ago. But again, based on a manga, well worth catching. And the final one I would pick is what I think is the finest adaptation of a manga, partly because I don't read a lot of manga, but one of the people's manga I do read is Junji Ito's sort of weird horror stuff. I'm not going for any of the Tomy films, of which there are lots. I'm going to go for the film of Uzumaki, which is... Uzumaki, I think, is Japanese for spiral. And it's just about this weird happening where spirals take over a town. Junji Ito has a very interesting drawing style. This film just brings it to life. Is it scary? No, it's not scary at all. But is it visually fascinating? And is it utterly true to its source material? Yes, it is. So if you can track a copy of Uzumaki down, I'd highly recommend it. And that's my lot.
Cool. Hey, you didn't want to like go with like the Guinea Pig movies or Angel Guts or something a little extreme? I wonder how the original source material for this stuff looks, because the films are bad enough.
A Mermaid in a Manhole was one, wasn't it, for example? Oh, and gosh. I was just thinking, like, really? I mean, I guess the difference in Japan, and this is very much a Japanese phenomenon, I think I could have, old boy aside, on the whole, I think we've only picked Japanese films, haven't we? We just have to remember that manga and anime are much more accepted forms of entertainment art than comic books they are in the West. Now it seems crazy to say, you know, the biggest films in the world are all the Marvel movies, but you know, historically that hasn't been the case, whereas anime and manga are, you know, everyone reads them, the young, the old, They read them on the train. They read them at home. They'll you know, desperate to get the next edition. And a lot of these things come out weekly, not monthly. So it's a rich place to get inspired to make live action movies. And the breadth of content, it's not just sci-fi and horror and genre stuff. There are manga about hospitals and taking your exams and crime and from the mundane to the crazy to the outrageous. And so it's no wonder it's a fine source of inspiration. Although I would suggest it's interesting that they bother making live action ones at all. Certainly of some of the anime, I just don't understand. If it's all culturally accepted, why bother making a live action remake? In the West, we tend to make a live action remake because it's a cartoon and it has little widespread readership, or that they want to take something foreign and anglicize it a little bit. So, yeah.
I don't know. I guess they've got to give all these pop stars something to do, because as we frequently find, especially when we look at like Hong Kong, you can't just be like a singer. You have to be a singer and an actor and a producer and a director. I mean, Jackie Chan, I mean, how many credits does he run with? I mean, seven. I mean, when we look at Thunderball, he's the director, he's the actor, he sings the theme tune. He has all these different like credits to his name, and I think that's why they have to keep doing live action films, just to give him something to do. But I don't know.
I guess it's an easy way to get something, you know, if something is popular.
Yeah.
We make it. And we do that here. It's just that the comic books and cartoons aren't adult fare here, are they? There are exceptions, of course there are, but on the whole we think of them as childish pursuits, which is a touch unfair.
I feel that it's an attitude that's certainly changing, especially as the Xennial generation are coming more into their own, as we obviously came up with anime. So our sort of how we view animation and certainly graphic novels and how stories can be told is certainly a lot different than like the previous generations, like the baby boomers, the MTV generation, the Gen Xers, who would obviously have set the taste standard. I mean, now when we look at like the wealth of anime and manga titles are available, and certainly the variety of titles available, it's a lot different than obviously back in the early 90s and when I first obviously started getting into anime, and it was just very sort of like giant mecha and action and horror and demon porn sort of titles. So they were very sort of set categories which existed, and now we've become very more open. Our tastes are like much more accepting of different sort of styles, and you can see it when you, especially if you like happen to be like going through even like Cartoon Network, and you see something like the animated style for My Little Pony Friendship is Magic, for example, or Adventure Time, or these series where you can see they clearly are drawing inspiration from the anime style. I mean, even when we like look at some of the new Marvel cartoons, such as like Ultimate Spider-Man, it's got a very anime style to it. And certainly through, I think, things such as like The Simpsons, obviously showing that you can do multi-tier humor, I think that has also played into it. So,
you didn't just out yourself as a brony then, did you, in the middle of that?
No, I'm just a pop culturally aware man. So.
Okay, I kid you. No, absolutely. I mean, just go to your local bookshop, sort of main chain bookshop in town. You will see there is now a huge section of manga. Yeah, it's an accepted thing, and those people grow up. If you read American superheroes, especially Marvel comic books, over the last 10 years, they have taken on the pacing of Japanese comic books. Yeah, a lot less happens, more time is taken, so a comic book may be one or two scenes rather than a full pulse pounding adventure from that they used to be in the 60s and the 70s. So definitely culturally that's taken over our culture in subtle ways and in really obvious ways, like some of the things that you've discussed yourself. So, and you know, and there's a reason that they made a live action remake of Ghost in the Shell. There's a reason Netflix are doing Death Note. Yeah, there's a generation of people who grew up with these and have had a desire to bring it over. And I think people are more accepting of it now. It's not going to be that crazy little strange thing. It's something that people are aware of.
Yeah, definitely. If you would like to share your favorite live-action adaptations, please do so. The Facebook group, as we said already, is now live and active. Come like us. Go support the group. It's just look for Asian Cinema Film Club. At the moment, I believe we have Maggie Chung as our picture there from Chungking Express. And on there, you know, come share your thoughts on Asian cinema. Let us know films you would like to see us review or subjects you would like to see discussed. Come get involved. As always as well, the comment section is open as well. So if you're listening to this via thatmomentin.com or you're listening to us via Podomatic or iTunes, then definitely let us know in the comment section what you think of the show and give us some feedback, as we always love to hear from you. But we are going to take a quick break, and when we return, we will be looking at our featured film for this episode, which is 2006 Death Note.
You are about to witness history in the making.
Hi there, this is Todd from Forgotten Films, and if you spend all your time watching new releases, then you need to broaden your movie horizons. And a great way to do that is by joining me for the Forgotten Filmcast. We don't talk about the new releases, we don't even talk about the classics. We talk about the movies that time forgot. On each episode, I'm joined by another film blogger to discuss a film that may or may not be worth rediscovering. So look for the Forgotten Filmcast on iTunes, Podomatic, and wherever you find great podcasts.
And we're back. You are still, of course, listening to the Asian Cinema Film Club. Tonight's featured film being 2006 Death Note. If you haven't done already, make sure you do check out the other podcasts on the thatmomentin.com podcast network. It's not only ourselves, we also have Cinema Recall there with The Van, who is currently looking at key films and directors. Recently he looked at Ed Wood. And coming up, he is also going to be looking at the Kill Bill, as he takes a look at ass-kicking women, in particular The Bride. So definitely exciting things happening on the network. So make sure you hit the subscribe buttons, whether you're listening on iTunes, Podomatic, or you're listening via the thatmomentin.com feed. We appreciate all your support. And as we said before the break, our Facebook group is now open. Just look for Asian Cinema Film Club and hit the like button and, you know, leave us your thoughts. But obviously tonight we are looking at 2006 Death Note. This is an adaptation of the wildly popular anime and manga, directed by Shinsuke Kaneko. I believe I'm pronouncing that right. Am I wrong? Steven, assume, tell me.
Shinsuke Kaneko.
There we go. Apologies as always if we are butchering any Asian names in this show.
Yeah, we're both as guilty as each other.
For those obviously not familiar with Death Note, it follows this rather simplistic plot where the Death Note is a book where if you write someone's name in the book, they will then die. And if you don't say how they die, they would just drop dead of a heart attack. And the film itself, it follows the Death Note as it falls into the hands of Light Yagami, who is a Japanese college student. He's currently studying to be a lawyer. And he uses the Death Note as a way to strike back at the criminal population of Japan and sees himself as his vigilante force of good. At the same time, his father, who is a... let's say he's a senior police detective. He's currently investigating this string of unusual murders, and his department starts receiving assistance from this mysterious figure known as L, who seems to know a lot about the murders and is determined, as the local police department, to obviously find out who is responsible for all these unusual deaths. And it's up to Light to basically try and find a way to take the focus off himself, especially as the cult around the Death Note grows ever more stronger. Now, Tim, I mean, had you seen Death Note before? I mean, how aware were you of the material?
No, I mean, I'd never seen the film before. I was aware of it and as a series and as of a thing. It's just not something I'd delved into before. So I came at it fairly cold. I knew the actors in it, so that helped. What you didn't say is that this is part one of two, and it's one of those things which I know got quite in vogue here in the West, where films would be part one and part two. They got quite into it in Japan for a bit as well. So I think what I wasn't prepared for was the spending 2 hours with it not to get a conclusion.
Yeah, it certainly has an open ending. If you watch this as just its own film, it feels like it comes to a very much a grinding halt all of a sudden. It's sort of like, oh, that's the ending? I kind of want to know what happens next. I mean, as you said already, I mean, this was followed by Death Note 2, The Last Name. There was also a spin-off film directed by Hideo Nakata, which was L Change the World, which released in 2008. And we got another sequel, Death Note Light Up the New World, which is due to be released in 2016. As well as, obviously, the American remake, which we obviously discussed a little bit about in the first half.
Yeah, and I think as a TV series as well in Japan as well. So this is clearly a popular franchise that is still popular, I suppose.
Oh yeah, definitely. I would say it's definitely popular. If you look at the anime fans, if you hang around Forbidden Planet or wherever you happen to buy your comic books from, you more than likely see one or two people with some sort of Death Note insignia, clothing or bag or something. It's become one of those popular series that the iconography of it is very instantly recognizable. Certainly, there's a lot of it based around apples, and in particular the God of Death, who appears to Light frequently and kind of comes across like his warped invisible friend.
Yeah, so I guess what we have to talk about is this, it's Ryuk, who's a Shinigami, like a god of death, who is a fully realized CGI character that sometimes works and sometimes doesn't work. Would that be fair to say?
I don't know. I mean, I really like Ryuk. I thought going into this that he would be much more a humorous character, but he's very much a one level sort of character. I think the fact he likes apples is about his most amusing trait. He's kind of the voice of reason in many ways. He tries to warn Light of the path he's heading down. At the same time, he also offers to upgrade Light's ability so that in fact he can see people and instantly see their names rather than having to do sort of like the detective legwork so that he can find people's names and add them to the Death Note.
It is interesting because I went in expecting, you know, Light to be a good chap who is corrupted by this god of death. But it's very quickly revealed that the guy we thought was going to be our hero is a frigging psychopath. And actually, the thing that we think of as the god of death is, as you say, almost the voice of reason. And yes, of course, he's tempting and all those things that evil gods tend to do. But even he, there's these wonderful looks on his face at times when Light does things he thinks, oh, you sure you want to do that? And then later on is, how did you do that? You know, he almost becomes a sympathetic character. You think, oh my god, what have I done here?
Oh, definitely. I think that when we get to the ending and we see Light obviously getting slowly corrupted by power, especially as he tries to cover his tracks, because obviously Interpol are closing in, we've got the FBI investigating him as well, and he's making all these sort of plans and schemes to try and cover his tracks so that he can't be revealed as Kira, which is like this name that is given for this, for who everyone assumes is doing the murders. They just assume that it's his serial killer known as Kira, and Kira himself as a cult figure is kind of like Mickey and Mallory in Natural Born Killers. It becomes this cult figure and this subject of like popular culture, and that you constantly have like characters like reference who they would like Kira to kill for them, like, oh, I would like Kira to kill my mother. Oh, only joking, because, you know, having saying you want your mother killed is such a funny joke about in Japan. So
yeah, it's I'm kind of on the fence about this film, because I think it's got a fantastic premise, right? I think, you know, it's got some pretty talented young actors in it. Yes, I was disappointed it screeched to a halt, but my biggest problem with it was it's 2 hours long, and I never really felt we delved into the big questions that the film's kind of asking. It felt very on one level. But there's all sorts of things going on in it, like Kira's existence as an internet thing, which I suppose back in 2006 the internet was a different place. But it's kind of interesting to hear how he becomes an internet message board sort of phenomenon, but we never really get to see it. And then the big questions are really, is it okay? Is capital punishment okay? that's the fundamental question, isn't it? And I'm never sure we really had the debate. We have a bunch of people, mostly light, who are saying, yep, I'm doing the right thing because these people are awful. And then we have a bunch of people, mostly on the police side, that are sort of saying, actually, no, you can't do this. You've got to have due process. There's questions about what if you've got the wrong person and blah, blah, blah. And then we have our other hero, L, which is very confusing, Light and L.
Yeah.
I guess that's, yeah. He's a lovely creation of really strange tics and mannerisms, and you know, in that regard, he's well created. And also, he's a little bit, you know, he doesn't mind using people to get to what he wants, so there's a moral ambiguity about him. But I have no idea who he is. I have no idea why the police force agreed to use him, because obviously he's been this great Sherlock Holmesian detective for years. And in fact, turns out the Japanese police force don't mind using teenage boys, because at the end, Light's going to be part of the task force as well. And I'm just thinking, really, in a country like Japan, they're absolutely reliant on children that haven't left high school yet.
Well, I mean, we have to also remember, I mean, Light offers to help his father in the case. He's sort of like, I want to help you, and he's like, no, save your strength. Like it's some great battle he's going to endure. It's such an unusual way of phrasing it.
It is, but it is hinted that he's helped before. That which is a bit like, oh, hello, where's this coming from? And I think the thing that the overall disappointment with the film for me is you've got these really interesting characters, and I don't think we ever really get to know them. And they get painted into these kind of very high level archetypes really very quickly, rather than it feeling like I don't feel like fell. I felt he didn't, he fell off the first step, and actually he was already pretty far down in the dark cellar of sociopathness, if not psychopathy. So I don't know. I struggled with it, because I could understand how the Death Note omniverse, the manga, the anime, the other films, could create a following, because it's asking some really interesting fundamental questions. I'm just not convinced this film was asking them all. And I wonder, therefore, as somebody maybe who's read the source material, whether that's much more part of it than it appeared to be in the film.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I've yet to read the actual manga. I mean, I've touched on the anime, and the thing I love about Death Note is always the mechanic of what Death Note is. This idea that you write the name of the person you want to kill in a book, and that you can choose how they die if you wish, or they can disrupt day of a heart attack. And I loved just the simple mechanic and how it's obviously used throughout the film. And actually
that does grow, doesn't it? Because to start with, all these people die of heart attacks, and you think, yeah, all right, this is that's well, fine.
Yeah.
But it isn't until the end where suddenly like gets creative with it. And suddenly I think he gets extraordinarily creative by the end of the film, where he's basically setting up multiple deaths reliant on each other. So he's basically setting up a situation where people die because of the actions that they are going to generate their own death by. And that's kind of clever. That got really interesting for me. So that's what, again, when it, I'd say the last act is by far the most interesting for me.
Oh, yeah. I think by the end, it's certainly getting creative. But even before then, when he starts getting the indication that he's being, that people are like following him, he starts getting creative. Like when we have the death of the prisoners, and he's created, so they all die in different ways. Like one's drawing the pentagram on the wall, the other's dropping dead of a heart attack, the other sort of kills himself. He's sort of getting more creative with his use of the Death Note then. I think certainly when we get onto like the bus sequence, where he's being followed by the FBI agent and he needs to identify who the agent is, that's really the first sort of standout moment of when he gets creative, and he sort of orchestrates this whole sequence where this guy, this criminal, is going to appear on the bus, and he's going to go through all these different actions before walking off the bus and essentially getting hit by a car. Yeah, he gets very creative and, should we say, a little far-fetched. And I think, because of the setup for the big ending, it does mean we end up with like half an hour of this film that could have been hacked off it. Certainly once we start getting into the FBI agent who's also following him around, and then the vengeful fiance who's then following him around, it's sort of like, we could just cut all that out and just have it as L trying to play games and avoid the attentions of L.
I have to say, one, I'm pretty sure the FBI is an American federal organization and doesn't have a Japanese agents in Japan. I just wonder if that's a translation thing or that. But I think they were pretty much saying the FBI. So the FBI wouldn't exist like that. So that annoyed the pedant in me. But yeah, God, it's just over 2 hours long.
Yeah.
I wanted to see these two kids face off against each other much, much sooner. And to find out the sequel is 2.5 hours long, I'm not sure I've got 5 hours of my life that I want to spend like this. It's just not quite, to me, just quite good enough to invest. But what I can see is that there's some really interesting questions, and like you're quite right, I was being a bit hard on it earlier. Now there is some creativity going on there, but I was much more interested in those questions of morality, which I don't think were really delved into.
Okay. I think the problem I've also got with it is that we have this character of L. Now, when L's introduced, he's just a voice on a laptop. Obviously, it's just the symbol, this like gothic L symbol. And I was like, oh my God, this is going to be great. We're not going to see who it is. And then it gets halfway point, and it's like, oh yeah, it's this guy who's also a college student, and he's got all of these tics, and he's somehow got all this money, which means he can sit in this like posh hotel room just gorging himself on junk food and drinking coffee. I mean, there's a great scene where he's stirring coffee with a lollipop after putting like half a pound of sugar in there, and you get all these like hints of his like tics, as you said. But it felt like kind of a letdown to see who L was after how this idea, how they build up the character initially.
Yeah, I mean, I'm okay with him being some kind of seventh boy child thing. That's okay. I mean, he's a teenager, isn't he? I mean, yeah. that's almost to be expected. But I still don't know anything about him. He gives a name. I doubt that's his real name. And I just know about his tics. I don't know where he's got all this money from. I don't know how this trust has been relayed in him. You know, he's just a interesting looking character. I mean, the actor is well known for playing kind of kooky and quirky people. So I imagine that's a tip off to his local audience. But he's just L, and he's just really clever, and clearly he has a little bit of amorality about him in a slightly different way to Light has, but I've no idea. I just don't know, it's very hard to connect with somebody if you don't know anything about them.
Just obviously to step back a tad, and we obviously mentioned about the character of Kira, this alternate personality that the internet essentially creates as a way to put a face on who is committing these murders. If we wanted a more modern comparison, we'd see like the Cult of Slender Man, for example, as another sort of creation of the internet. And I think when we look at creations such as Kira, it seems to be, again, be a very sort of Japanese thing, as we also have this message board culture that perhaps we don't quite have the same over here in the West. And you have like characters like Kira, you have like the Train Man, this whole storyline about this boy who saves a girl from being attacked on the subway, and this whole relationship that was like built around rumors and myths of what happened to these two characters, with people claiming they knew them and that they were there. And Kira is essentially just like a more morbid version of Train Man in many ways. And I love the way that the fact that all these people just created this creation, the fact that they all agree on just this one name, because it's not like Light throws the name out there or anything like that. He doesn't create this alternate personality. The internet and the public conscious create this character for themselves.
Kira is, and if this hadn't come from Japan, it'd almost be racist, but it just comes from the way that Japanese people can't say the L in killer. It's literally that, and you know, there's no bones about it. So I find that I'm going to be interested if they copy that in the Netflix remake, because I think that might be a little more difficult to translate.
Cool. Is there anything else that you want to raise about this? I mean, does it inspire you to? I think you said already you're not going to watch the second one because of its runtime.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm intrigued to see where it goes. I will watch the Netflix one as well. Yeah. I mean, you're not wrong. There's a core story here, and there's a core mechanic at play that's just really interesting. And there are other films which have played on this as well. And you know, this is 2006, so this is actually quite a long time ago in technology terms. So it's also very interesting, like you say, about the stuff that's going on the internet at the time. It's quite prescient in some ways, you know, the way we get cults of people, that a cult of personality of people that are doing bad things effectively, but will have their backers. So it's interesting. I just think I wanted it to be more. I wanted more.
Yeah.
And when I think this is from the director who has put together some really, really fun films. Yeah. One of the things I watched the first of his Gamera trilogy. What a huge amount of fun that is. And that doesn't waste any time at the same time as, well, you know, it's a very fast paced thing. It takes its time with the big reveals, but you know, it's still quite punchy and pacey. And I didn't feel this one ramped up to anything. I felt it started at one pace and never went up or down.
Now, obviously with the the ending, we obviously have the showdown between Light and L. We have the introduction of a second Death Note. There's certainly a lot of things going that sort of leave it open for the sequel, which made me interested to see. I just hope, can only hope, the second one's got more pacing, slightly better pacing.
Yeah, and obviously, I guess the other weird thing is obviously there are things that are going to play out in the second one which are dropped in this one. So there's another Death Note turns up. There's a young, I don't know what she is. Is she like a TV celebrity or something?
Yeah, she's like a young sort of TV host, because she hosts the cooking show, which is about making your love rivals fat.
Yes, it's a bit weird, but she's obviously she's quite a vocal supporter of Kira. But and you think, oh, where's this going? And then so nothing happens until like right at the end, where she gets another Death Note, and I think, oh, hang on a minute, I've been watching this for 2 hours. Where's this going? And then clearly, that's the sequel. So at least it was designed to be two films, which sometimes you know the second film is just an unnecessary add-on. So whilst I'm not a huge fan of this practice of two films where one would do, I think, you know, there's something there. If I have 2.5 hours free one day, I will probably finish the set.
Cool. Now, obviously, to wrap up, I mean, further viewing, I mean, what would you like to pair with this one?
Gosh, you know, obviously, we've probably covered a whole bunch of films that, if we're going to sort of go on the manga adaptation, that we probably could add. But I'm going to go for something a little bit different. It's a South Korean film called Killer Toon, which is about a cartoonist who has a popular web series. So in South Korea, web comics are a huge thing, much more than they are anywhere else. You know, literally things that are designed to be on the internet. And her creations basically start killing people. So things that she puts up there in her cartoons end up being real deaths. And so it's a sort of a crime horror film. And it's, I really like it. I really love the lead actress, Lee Si-young. It's a little bit, you know, it's an unusual premise, but, and a little bit crazy, but I think it works. So it's definitely something worth hunting down.
Okay. My choice is going to be going with a film directed by our sort of man of the moment, and that's Sion Sono. And the film I'm going to obviously choose from his back catalogue films is Suicide Club, as this is a film which also revolves around unusual deaths. This is a film which is arguably a little unbalanced for some tastes, but it does feature that also memorable scene of about 54 teenage schoolgirls committing mass suicide by throwing themselves in front of an oncoming train, which is probably why most people know it and why it's got such a cult appeal. It's not the best film by Sion Sono, but I feel that it ties in well to obviously the themes that we've been talking about with Death Note. So if you want to see unusual deaths, and certainly a film based around police trying to find the reasons why these suicides are happening, then this is, in to that respect, a film, the sort of pairing that I would make between these two films. As I said, it's not the best film that Sono has directed, but at the same time, there is enough interesting things happening there to make it certainly worth giving a view.
I mean, I really like Suicide Club. It's an indie horror, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's got some fantastic set pieces in it. It doesn't quite hang together, but it's well worth a watch, and certainly as an introduction to Sono's work, I think of his earlier films, it's easily the most approachable.
You're saying people shouldn't like do the 4-hour epic Love Exposure as their introduction?
I love Exposure, but Love Exposure is the beginning of his next step up. There are certain phases of Sono, but like Noriko's Dinner Table and things like that are I find a bit of a drag. we could talk a lot about Sono's films, and I suspect we will.
Cool. Well, that brings us to another end of another edition of the Asian Cinema Film Club. Thank you, everyone, as always, for listening. Next selections. What are you going to go with, Stephen?
Well, funny enough, we've talked a lot about Sion Sono, and I'm going to pick a Sion Sono film.
Of course.
Because I think we're coming up to Halloween. So I was thinking about picking a nice horror film. Now, I was going to be really boring and pick some South Korean schoolgirl horror film, and I will one day. But I thought we'd go for something a little bit to help people introduce people into Asian cinema. I thought I would pick Sion Sono's XD Hair Extensions, which is a Japanese comedy horror. And the reason it's a good introduction film, it stars Chiaki Kuriyama, who people will probably recognize as that chick from Kill Bill and Battle Royale. But it's a very different sort of film, so I'm hoping you'll enjoy it.
Cool. As always, you can find our whole back catalogue of episodes on thatmomentin.com. We are now fully up to date on the podcast network there. If alternatively, you can subscribe through Podomatic and iTunes to make sure you never miss an episode. But Simon, if people obviously want to follow your work, where is the best place to come and find you?
Yeah, can come and find me at my own blog, which is gueloramblings.wordpress.com. You can find lots of my writing, not just reviews, but articles and interviews at easternkicks.com. And if you just want to get hold of me directly, well, I think we'll just use the Facebook page now.
Cool. As for myself, I'm on Twitter, which is at Elwood_Jones. You can also find my blog, From the Depths of DVD Hell, at blogspot.co.uk. And still on thatmomentin.com, if you're still not, if you want to read some of my ramblings there, you can via Game Warp, where I'm writing about video games, and also you can follow my movie location series called The Movie Tourist, where we look at different movie locations and how they play into different movies. So that is currently all over at thatmomentin.com. Until next time, thank you as always to my co-host Stephen.
It's a pleasure as always, mate.
And until next time, this is Edward Jones signing off for another edition of the Asian Cinema Film Club and saying good night. Hey! 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 昨日の小振りは忘れて、昨日のあの子は忘れて、踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。月が砕け散っても星が燃えて落ちても、踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。胸に刺さった恋の刃が燃える思いを狂わすのさ。昨日の恋は忘れて、昨日のあの子は忘れて、踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。